From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Marriage equality marches on, the dangers of being female, and graduation season is here. Plus, the Pope visits the Holy Land. That's what's coming up in the next hour on State of Belief Radio. Now, friends, remember, this program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help us keep this show on the air.
And as I've been in those foreign countries and also throughout the United States, I've seen the tangible example of how horribly women and girls are treated, much worse than anyone knows.
Earlier this month in Khartoum, Sudanese authorities sentenced a pregnant woman to death. In this case, the crime was Christianity. But from Sudan to Nigeria, from China to campus attacks in the United States, a pervasive double standard often leaves women vulnerable at best and all too often enslaved, brutalized, and even dead. Former President Jimmy Carter has called violence against women the most pervasive human rights violation in the world. On this week's show, I'll talk with the Reverend Jennifer Crumpton, who labels herself a femme evangelical.
Education is still the key to real and lasting freedom.
America needs you.
The possibilities are unlimited.
I want you to be fearless. I want you to be decisive.
We know it's graduation season by the news coverage of commencement speeches from Michelle Obama, Eric Holder, Sandra Bullock, and Sean Puff Daddy Combs, to name only a few. But in today's world and economy, what are this year's graduates commencing on? I'll talk about that with the Reverend Dr. Serene Jones, president of Union Theological Seminary in New York City. Plus, the Pope's unprecedented interfaith initiative in Israel this weekend.
The Pope, during his visit, is to meet the senior Muslim leader and two chief rabbis of Jerusalem.
I'll also talk with Religion News Service editor-in-chief Kevin Ekstrom about that same subject. But first,
it's a win.
A federal judge down in Eugene has struck down Oregon's gay marriage ban.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett said today that he would not challenge a federal judge's ruling striking down the state's ban on gay marriage.
Gay couples in Idaho could get married as soon as Friday.
Same-sex marriage is legal in Arkansas tonight.
A federal judge says Texas' ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional.
The ban on same-sex marriages in Virginia heads into the courtroom.
The genie is not getting put back in a bottle.
In just this past week, courts have overturned bans on marriage equality in two states, Oregon and Pennsylvania. This comes on the heels of similar recent decisions in Idaho and, yes, in Arkansas. While that last ruling has been stayed, as such rulings have in places like Texas, there is obviously tremendous change afoot. Joining me now to look at these encouraging developments is Dr. Sharon Groves, a good friend who is the director of the Religion and Faith Program at the Human Rights Campaign. Sharon, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
I know that HRC, as well as you personally, have been working extremely hard and for a very long time towards the kind of change that we're finally beginning to see. How do these latest rulings make you feel?
Oh, it's just tremendous. When you have right now 44% of Americans that live in states with marriage equality, that's enormous. This is such a transformational moment we're living in. And I can say personally, as the director of the Religion and Faith Program, I feel it's a really good moment for LGBT equality. But it's actually a great moment for religion because we're seeing a real shift in the culture wars, and religion has been absolutely front and center in all of the states that have moved in this direction.
That is worthy of an exclamation point,
yes.
I think. If there's anything particularly notable about any of these rulings, I wish you'd point that out.
Well, I think it's what's notable is the way this is all happening. It was just in 2012 when we were doing this extensive ground game, which we still did. We have been doing that in Oregon, for instance. But the way that it's shifted since the DOMA decision, that the decisions are getting made at the courts, is a fascinating moment. And I think what it's telling us is that even in conservative parts of the country, where we might not have expected to win at the ballot box for 5 years, 10 years out, we're seeing changes that are kind of shocking us, like in Arkansas. Right. And it's very, very clear, I think the writing is on the wall, that we will eventually have marriage equality in all 50 states.
Sharon, did the DOMA decision free these judges to make decisions they would have already made had they had the courage or opportunity, or is that pushing the whole legal system because of that ruling?
I think it's a little of a chicken and the egg issue. I mean, I do think that there is a freeing up. I actually think that there are less hardliners out there, both in our judicial system, in our legislative branches, and in our places of worship. There are less hardliners than we have previously thought there were. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are beginning to be freed up. The reason for that, I think, is somewhat complicated. And I think a lot of it has to do with the changing hearts and minds work that we've seen happen on the ground in states across the country.
Do you think we're at a point where it's going to be very hard for any court to buck this trend?
Yes, I think we're getting there. I don't think we're there yet. The Human Rights Campaign has been doing some intensive work in some of the hardest places recently, like Mississippi and Alabama and Arkansas. And in those locations, there's still this sense out there that if you are religious, for instance, you must by definition be antagonistic to LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. So the culture wars still hold great sway in those locations. But it's shifting. You're even seeing it shift there as well. So, yes, you're right, I think, that the trend can't be bucked. But it's going to take some time, and there's an unevenness in terms of where in the country you see a swell toward acceptance and inclusion and where it's behind.
You mentioned the role that religion is playing, and I'd like to have you talk about that a little more in the sense of, is it because that leaders of religion are speaking out, or is it because that people in families have sons and daughters who are gay and wanting to marry the one they love, or is it all of that?
It's all of that. I see the move in religious spaces as threefold. One, I think it's been slow but really effective organizing on the ground that's been going on for decades, where progressive and moderate religious leaders and just ordinary people of faith in the pews have said enough. We support marriage equality. We support it as a principle of our faith, not in spite of it. And those numbers have just grown and grown and grown. When I started doing this work in 2005, there really wasn't such a thing as a faith organizer in a marriage campaign. And now every campaign that has anything to do with LGBT equality has faith organizers on the ground. So that's a real shift, and that shifted the conversation. I think the second piece is that a younger generation in very conservative denominations, like even we've even seen some movement recently with the Southern Baptists, like that the younger generation is saying we do not want to be associated with the intolerance that we saw in our parents' generation. And they're either leaving the church or they're challenging it. And the challenge is not necessarily support marriage equality, but it's saying we need to be in a dialogue and we can't afford to let the culture wars stick. And so we're seeing real openings and some ambivalence, a sense of not knowing where to go, but we're seeing openings in the most surprising of places. And then I think thirdly, we're finally chipping away at the monolith, that's what I like to call it, of this sort of this notion that if you are religious, by definition, you must be opposed to marriage equality. You must be opposed to LGBT inclusion. That it's just it's a defining characteristic of our faith. We're moving away from that. We are seeing that people of faith, they're wrestling with this question, and they end up on multiple perspectives on it.
I certainly don't want any of our listeners to think that we as a nation just got up one morning and had changed our mind. I mean, there has been tremendous work going on, and already you have said that HRC has been organizing. You've had people in the field working.
You know, people look to Stonewall as the beginning of the gay liberation movement. And before Stonewall, we had dignity chapters. We had marriages that were sanctified in United Church of Christ and in metropolitan community churches and Reformed Judaism. I mean, so there has been faith work. It's been engaged at the forefront.
Right.
There's a mythology out there that faith just got on the bandwagon yesterday.
Right.
At the Human Rights Campaign, we've had a religion and faith program now for 8 years. And through that work, we have engaged at least a faith director or a faith organizer in pretty much every state that has moved toward marriage equality. Since after Massachusetts, in some level or another, we've had some engagement. Around 2012 was our high water mark. It was in every state. So, and it was often as a faith director with faith organizers on the ground, building support in religious communities. Now, most recently, we're seeing the need to be able to go into spaces that are not on the coast, where there is a really deep need for an investment in communities that have often been overlooked. And so we're focused right now in a very deep way in Mississippi, Alabama, and Arkansas.
Yeah. Well, and the Arkansas ruling, by any judgment, is a source of hope for all of us. And I don't say that in a disparaging way, because there are a lot of things good in Arkansas, but it is not the hotbed of liberalism.
Yes.
And to see what's happening there is good. I can't help but just reflect a second, because when I came to D.C. 16 years ago, Elizabeth Birch and I had a good relationship when she was at the HRC. And I remember several press conferences that we did, because at that time there was not a faith component in HRC. And there were only three or four of us in town that did those press conferences together. I say all of that to affirm what you've said. I think it was crucial for HRC to have a religion and faith program. And it had to be someone that knew both religion and faith, but also politics and organizing. And you've been that kind of person.
Well, thank you, Welton, and you've been that kind of person, too. And I remember very fondly the work that you did helping to empower faith leaders that came to Washington, D.C. to advocate for LGBT equality, to be able to help them understand how best to tell their story as faith leaders to members of Congress. And that kind of interaction between the faith leaders and Congress people is absolutely critical. That's the work we need to do. There is a lot of work to be done in the religious space, in the public square.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This has happened far faster than I thought it would.
Right.
And now then, we're seeing, as you mentioned, evangelical leaders being pushed by the younger members of their denominations, and they are beginning to speak up. Do you see the incredibly destructive God versus gay paradigm finally collapsing? Are some LGBT people finding a way to forgive organized religion for what was done to them in the name of faith?
Yeah, I really do. And I think, you know, the most powerful thing, and why I sort of started by saying I think it's a great moment for religion, is that as we know, when marginalized people return to their faith and wrestle with it, everyone else ought to just stand up and take notice, because it changes the whole culture.
Mm.
So, for instance, there's a young trans person that we work with, and he had said to me recently that he was praying in his living room one night, and then simply said yes to whatever or however God wanted to use him. Mm-hmm. And it was a turning point that gave him the kind of the strength to go through the process of fully transitioning. And then he brings that public witness into the congregation that he's in, and everybody is changed in the process. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing these people that have been, when people are rejected and they reclaim their faith, it changes everybody. The same is true when you have straight pastors that may have been homophobic or even mildly antagonistic at one point, mm-hmm. and go through a journey and shift their perspective. It's a very deep and heartfelt thing, and it changes the whole conversation. So that kind of work, I think, is what's going to save our faith communities in the end.
I've been speaking with Dr. Sharon Groves, director of the Religion and Faith Program at the Human Rights Campaign. I say without apology, she is a heroine for many of us, and her work has paid off in saving a lot of lives. Sharon, I really do appreciate you taking time to be with us today. It feels like we've only scratched the surface of some important topics, so I really do want you to come back soon. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the time, and thank you for your ministry.
The Reverend Jennifer Crumpton calls herself a femme evangelical, a powerful and inspiring voice for inclusion and empowerment. She's the Vice President of Strategic Partnerships for the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, and she's a pastoral associate of Park Avenue Christian Church in New York City. Jennifer, welcome to State of Belief.
Hi, Reverend Gaddy. Thank you so much for having me.
This story that's gotten quite a bit of attention this week, and Miriam Ibrahim, 8 months pregnant, sentenced to death in Sudan. There are barbaric policies in countries around the world. Would you agree that very often they primarily victimize women?
Absolutely. I think the very simple answer to that is yes. And actually, the NGO that I work for, the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, is very active in working with our networks around the world to try to make a difference in situations like the one that you just brought up. And we do that through peace networks of interreligious groups.
Uh-huh.
But you're absolutely right. What it typically comes down to is that women are much, much more vulnerable to witch hunts, if you will,
yeah.
of this nature around the globe. It's just a fact of life.
I think people have seen somewhere the story that the National Council of Churches of Christ has taken a position on this. Other denominations have. Are you aware of people of faith other than these working to help in this desperate situation?
Well, I am. In the form of interfaith networks of people who prefer not to be named, actually,
mm-hmm.
because they do try to work on the ground, making the necessary connections to try to find justice in these situations. And, you know, very much like the situation with the Nigerian schoolgirls that we're seeing, oftentimes on the ground, justice is very complex.
Mm-hmm.
And very difficult to attain, and takes a lot of different people working together.
There are stories of brutality in other regions and not always under the guise of religion. Is there something crucial that we're missing when it comes to basic human rights for women in these societies?
Absolutely. And I have to say that I'm actually heartened because of the reach of social media and the internet and our communications abilities today, I really believe we're about to see an uprising and an awareness like we've never seen before over issues of sexual and social violence toward girls and women. I actually just picked up Jimmy Carter's new book called A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. And it's so interesting because he's in such a prime position as a former president and activist. He's visited over 145 countries, he and his wife, Rosalind. And he says the most serious and unaddressed worldwide challenge is the deprivation and abuse of women and girls. And he says, you know, based on his observations and experiences, it's largely caused by a false interpretation of carefully selected religious texts and a growing tolerance of violence and warfare. Mm-hmm. And like you said, it's not always specifically caused by religious beliefs around the world, but very often our secular behaviors and what we tolerate or don't tolerate is dictated by our ancient religious sensibilities. So it's a very nuanced mix there, but I do think that our faith is also the answer. Mm-hmm. So we can't just say that religion is only bad and only causes problems and violence. It also holds the answer in many ways.
You work to empower women within their faith traditions. How do you do that? What are the ways you've seen organized religion drop the ball or pick up the ball when it comes to women in the church?
Well, you know, it's going to sound almost ridiculously simple, but the way that I go about my work is actually a product of a really long personal process of learning that I have a voice and becoming confident enough to tell my own personal story. And that's my call to women, especially religious women today, to tell our stories and not be afraid. You know, I think this is why women and girls around the world and the men who support us are so intrigued and supportive of helping the Nigerian schoolgirls. It's because we all actually resonate so deeply with what's happening there, even though our circumstances are so different. Mm-hmm. And they clearly have a very different lifestyle that where they're enduring violence on a daily basis and even scared to go to school. But for me, I grew up in the buckle of the Bible Belt in the 70s and 80s in the Southern Baptist Church. And there were no women leaders, and there was absolutely no talk of women's equality. And, you know, our religious beliefs really taught us as women that, you know, we were just supposed to think that things were just fine as they were. We were under the headship and authority of men, and these men made the decisions and interpreted the Bible, and we were supposed to believe it and live it, and it was supposed to be God's will for us.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually a victim of sexual violence while at my small Southern Christian private college.
Mm.
And because of my hyper-religious sort of male-dominant upbringing, I was too frightened to tell anyone because what had been so deeply instilled in me in the guise of spirituality and religious faith was that I was secondary and I was under the headship of men, and men knew better than me in pretty much every instance. So I knew that I wouldn't be believed if I told anybody. I would be blamed while the boy would be believed. And, you know, the questions would be asked of me, what were you doing? What did you do to cause this?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I write about that really seems to resonate with women is the whole idea of Eve being the cause of original sin by tempting the man. It just seems to play out over and over again, and it stems from our religious beliefs and misinterpretations of texts and doctrines. But it's really dug its way very deeply into our cultural memory and our cultural mm-hmm. understanding of how women and men interact. So, you know, I lost my college years because of that, and deep depression and anxiety and having post-traumatic symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't tell anyone for a decade. And when I did, actually, interestingly, I, you know, was faced with exactly the reaction I feared I would have been faced with 10 years prior. And that was, well, what were you doing? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so all of this to say is that in whatever circumstance it is, and almost every woman has an example, it might not be similar to mine, but have been sexually assaulted or there's been some sort of emotional violence, we think that we get what we deserve. And we think that this is the will of God. So we remain silent, and we see our secular system really doing the same thing, police encouraging women not to report sexual violence, We're seeing a huge uprising on especially Ivy League campuses right now, college campuses, you know, where girls are under attack constantly and having, you know, situations of sexual assault, and the administration is repressing them. And, you know, the boy stays on campus while the girl is traumatized or has to leave. So this type of sexual violence is happening everywhere. And so women have to be encouraged to tell our stories, also to reframe the way that we look at our faith tradition in order to empower us, as opposed to make us into further into victims or secondary status.
Well, Jennifer, I first of all, appreciate you being very personal in the conversation, and I know that is a powerful recall that both hurts when you remember it, but gives you great credibility in talking with others in what you do. I don't know whether you know, I was in the Southern Baptist Convention as well, and to this day, in Southern Baptist seminaries, like Southwestern in Fort Worth, a woman cannot give a theological lecture to a classroom filled with men because women don't have that kind of authority.
Right. And, you know, it's so funny that you bring that up, because my sexual assault occurred in 1994, and then I later moved to New York City, and I really went through a process of growing and exploring my faith. And I came back to Birmingham to visit my family in 2008, not long ago, right? And
right.
I was in preparation to go into seminary at Union Theological Seminary. I was very excited about that change in my career path from advertising. And so I'm in Birmingham, and I heard about this mega church that had this new pastor who was in his 20s. And I thought, you know, I really feel called to just go over there and just go to a service and see what's happening, because this could be cool. And so I go, and I'm there with my mom, and they're nominating deacons and elders. And the pastor, David Platt, who was in his late 20s at the time, got up on the stage and basically said, "But you can't nominate women." And then he went on to preach a sermon. This is someone in my generation. preached a sermon based on 1 Timothy about how God does not allow women to be in leadership positions. And I thought, God, I thought you were nudging me to come here today. I'm about to start seminary. And this is horrible. Like, you know, I just retracted by 10 years.
I bet.
Just sitting here. And then I realized that actually God had led me there to show me something, that this was still happening. There were hundreds of little girls in that auditorium that day. And they learned something about themselves from that pastor. And I learned that this was my calling in seminary. It ignited this righteous rage in me. Like, I had been so infiltrated by patriarchal language of religion, but it had never occurred to me until then.
Yeah.
Like, this type of nuanced and subtle way, and very blatant way also, of talking about women in the church is what made me not report my rape.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Boy.
It's all connected. You get this message that you're less important, you're less worthy. It doesn't necessarily really matter what happens to you, and you have no credibility or recourse to stand up for yourself. So once I made that connection, semi-evangelical was really born.
Would you say two sentences about what it means to be a femme evangelical?
Being a femme evangelical is to believe the core of the gospel of Jesus, and that is that he came to the earth to do what he said when he read from Isaiah chapter 61, to proclaim good news to the poor and freedom for prisoners and sight for the blind and to set the oppressed free. And so women must speak up. We have to help to bring the realm of God to earth by fighting for who we are and for our own equality in the eyes of God.
The Reverend Jennifer Crumpton is a widely respected public speaker and writer. She's Vice President of Strategic Partnerships for the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, and she is a pastoral associate at Park Avenue Christian Church in New York City. Jennifer, I appreciate your candor, your insight, and just appreciate your presence on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here with you.
All month long, institutions of higher learning are gift-wrapping their graduates in caps and gowns and sending them out into the world to fend for themselves. Despite record levels of student loan debt and false urban legend stories claiming that 85% of these graduates will find themselves living in their parents' basements, a good number of these graduates will go on to significantly impact the world in which the rest of us live. Joining me now is the Reverend Dr. Serene Jones, president of Union Theological Seminary. Dr. Jones, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. I'm so happy to be a part of this conversation.
A few months ago, you wrote a compelling article for Time magazine in which you talked about the sophisticated new veneer American materialism has taken on, as demonstrated in this year's Super Bowl ads. And I have to say, that article could serve as a terrific commencement speech in and of itself. So I'd like to start from there. Do you think this year's graduates might be more idealistic than in recent years, or is it just that we've learned to describe ambition in more nuanced terms?
Oh, what a great question. I think this year's graduates, at least at Union, are as idealistic, if not more, than they've ever been. Mm-hmm. In that article about the Super Bowl commercials, what I was trying to get at was the extent to which a veneer, a very progressive view of everything from same-sex marriage to racial equality to economic justice, served as the background for advertisements that were really trying just to sell cars and beer and all sorts of things that couldn't be farther from social justice than one could imagine. Yeah. And the challenge, I think, in that context is to have students and a new generation of leaders who aren't taken in by the flash and the patina of our commercialism, mm-hmm. but can see beneath it to the truth. I mean, I have to say, seeing Bob Dylan walk through a smoky room that looks like it's the middle of a protest to come out and sell us cars is a sign that something is gravely amiss in our culture.
Boy, you're right. What about the restrictions that huge student loans impose on what a young person can even choose to do once she or he is out of school?
Yeah, no, right now it's devastating, the consequences of that. I think it's felt most forcefully in students who are coming out of seminaries in that they have the double burden of big loans and not stepping into a job market that has a lot of positions, mm-hmm. And even more, that has positions that can pay at a level that allows them to pay back their loans. Now, that said, I think most seminary students go to seminary not anticipating that they're going to come out making a lot of money, or these days even knowing they're going to find a job. So what's inspiring to me is the level of creativity and social entrepreneurship I see amongst the graduates who are very realistic about what they're facing.
Do you have a sense, Serene, as to how like or unlike students coming out of the universities that students coming out of seminaries are?
Well, I think in the past, let's say, 4 years at Union, representing a seminary, the number of students coming to us straight out of undergraduate have increased dramatically. Mm-hmm. And this gives me a sense of what's going on in an undergraduate population. And I think that there is a sea change on college campuses with respect to being disconcerted, disillusioned mm-hmm. with the values of the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. Students mm-hmm. in college and universities today are under no illusions that we have systems that are working. They are not oblivious to the kind of economic constraints that they are going to be forced to live under. But rather than giving up and falling into a state of despair, which I'm sure many are, but the majority are finding new avenues for expressing their social discontent and trying to vision a different future.
Yeah,
I think you saw that in Occupy Wall Street as just one example. Mostly kids in or just out of college.
That makes, as I see it, that makes restrictions imposed by debts even more frustrating. If you have a vision of really wanting to change the world, but you know you've got to pay off student loans, does that impact the way students make decisions?
It must have a profound impact on the way they make decisions. But I think it's the combination of the debt and not having a lot of job opportunities that is going to push people to do even more creative things. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if you have a big debt and you can get out and you're being offered a job making $100,000 instead of a job making $50,000. Mm-hmm. The $50,000 might be more progressive, the $100,000 less. You're not finding any jobs.
Right.
And so that's where the creativity is coming from.
My sense is that people coming out of a seminary like yours are really wanting to impact society, change the world, influence people around them. How do they grapple with the challenges then of difficulty with jobs, low salaries, and the inability to live just above the poverty level?
Well, they're dealing with it in a number of ways. A good portion of students are getting part-time jobs, working in coffee shops or waiting tables. One of our best students is a bartender down the street, and finding ways to do their community service and social justice work on the side. More and more students, I find, are constructing forms of communal living after they leave seminary so that they can live together and share a ministry of social justice. And I think that there is a great desire to come up with some innovative ways to both generate revenue and regenerate communities. So one example of this is at Union, we've taken a kitchen, a big industrial kitchen that we've had, and turned it into a food lab where graduating students as well as people in the community can come and start their own business cooking. And it's a program that's also taking in people who've just been released from prison as well as people in the surrounding neighborhood who are presently unemployed. It's just an example of the kind of, I think, social entrepreneurship we're going to see more and more of.
See, I think that makes everything you've said more important, because you're not only teaching social justice skills, you're also enabling them to know how to cope with the environment and perhaps the reduction of resources. In your Time magazine article, you identify the threat of a sort of commercialization of social justice. How would you caution a newly graduated person about that?
Well, I think the temptation to a newly graduated person is to fall into a kind of, someone used this word the other day, a slacktivism, where you begin to believe that by drinking the right kind of beer and buying the right kind of car, you're actually contributing in some, you know, monumental way to social change and social justice. Mm-hmm. That while it's not insignificant what kind of beer you drink and what kind of car you drive, this does not pass for addressing the deep social issues ahead of us.
Yeah. Serene, if you were to deliver a commencement address to the class of 2014, and as far as I know you may have, what would be the most important points you'd want to make?
Well, I actually had the good fortune of doing that this graduation to the Union graduating seniors, and it was a simple message taken straight from Scripture, but it could be applied in any number of situations. And it was the words of Micah: act justly, love, kindness, and mercy, and walk humbly with your God.
That's awfully hard to beat.
It's awfully hard to do, too.
It is. The Reverend Dr. Serene Jones is president of Union Theological Seminary in New York City and ordained minister. She's vice president of the American Academy of Religion. Dr. Jones is the author of the book Trauma and Grace: Theology in a Ruptured World. Dr. Jones, I really thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
This weekend, Pope Francis is in the Holy Land for a 3-day visit. During the trip, he's meeting with Jewish and Islamic faith leaders, as well as the head of the Orthodox Church. Momentous and symbolic, the trip is not without its share of controversy, particularly over a planned Catholic Mass at a site that's also considered holy by Orthodox Jews and Muslims. But Francis has already shown that he has a gift for turning controversy into the good. With me is Kevin Ekstrom, Editor-in-Chief of Religion News Service. Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Pope Francis is different. Do you think this makes this trip different?
Well, it does, because this is the first pope to visit the region without the history and the baggage of the Holocaust that John Paul and Benedict XVI had. You know, of course, Benedict was drafted into the Nazi youth movement, and so when he went to Jerusalem, it carried a certain symbolism. John Paul, of course, grew up during World War II and had friends who died in the Holocaust, and so that was, had its own sort of symbolism. Francis, I think, represents a new page, kind of a fresh start, I think, for relations between the various religions of the region and the Catholic Church. And he has talked about issues that seem to sort of resonate there, minority rights and the working poor and access to jobs and, you know, sort of workaday issues that certainly seem to be resonating on the ground there. So I think it's a different kind of pope coming to the region.
Kevin, talk about the interreligious events that are part of the pope's schedule in the Holy Land.
It's important to remember that the main reason that the pope is going is not necessarily to go to the Western Wall and meet with Jews or to go to the West Bank and meet with Muslims. He's actually going to meet with the Eastern Orthodox. It was the main purpose of this trip because it commemorates the trip 50 years ago that Paul VI took to meet the head of Eastern Orthodoxy for the first time ever in Jerusalem. So it's a commemorative trip in that respect. And Pope Francis will be meeting for four times this trip with Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, who represents Eastern Orthodoxy. And that piece of it, which is actually fairly important, gets overshadowed a lot by the Jewish and Muslim aspects of the trip. But while he's there, he's going to go to the Western Wall, as previous popes have done before him. He's going to meet with President Peres of Israel and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel to talk about Middle East peace. He will be going to Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust memorial. And he will also be going to the West Bank and meeting with President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority and meeting with refugees. But he's also going to Jordan, which also is one of those things that kind of can get overlooked. But he's going to be holding a mass in Jordan, which has a very small but protected Catholic minority. And one of the interesting things he's going to be doing is holding a mass and giving First Communion to 1,600 kids. Not something that those kids probably ever imagined getting their First Communion from the Pope.
Kevin, what about these protests from some Orthodox Jewish activists? Is it significant, or is it more or less just what's expected when the Catholic Pope plans to hold Mass in a facility that's considered by all three Abrahamic religions holy?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it expected, but certainly I think it's a small minority, but a very vocal one that is trying to make its presence heard. And essentially the dispute is the Pope is going to go visit the place that is traditionally believed to be the site of the Last Supper for Christians, and for Jews, it also happens to be King David's tomb. And the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem are very worried that the Christians are going to try to take over the site, or that when the Pope comes, that that will give credence to the movement, that it's more of a Christian site than a Jewish site. Real estate is very complex over there. But what's interesting is the Catholic Church in the area and the State of Israel have both said that the Catholics have no interest in controlling it. So I think it's people getting their backs up, blowing off a little bit of steam, trying to make their voice heard. But I don't think it's going to necessarily derail the trip, but it's certainly added a layer of complexity that maybe they weren't anticipating.
Kevin, I know that it's a memorial visit, as you pointed out, but is there anything new on the agenda for four meetings with the Orthodox Patriarch?
Well, so the Orthodox and the Catholics have been split for 1,000 years. And it's tied up in history and in politics, but also in theology. And I don't know that they're going to be able to resolve all of that. But what this does is it sends a signal from both sides that they do want closer relations, and they want to get over this thousand-year split. It's going to take some time to do, but unless you have the leaders at the top buying into that, it's never going to happen. And yeah. So what this says is this is a priority for both sides. You know, ultimately, I think both of the Catholics and the Orthodox would like to recognize each other's ministers and allow communion in both churches, and in some places even allow, you know, marriages or between the two churches. Mm-hmm. All of that can't happen now. Sure. And there's going to be a great degree of work that's going to be involved in trying to overcome that. But I think this is a signal that the issue remains alive, and how the Vatican has built this is as a Christian unity trip between the two sides. Mm-hmm. And there's a subtle acknowledgement that there will never be unity there unless there's a commitment to it. And I think that's what this trip is trying to show.
Is there anything else that we should be watching out for on this papal visit?
Whenever the Pope or any religious leader really wades into this part of the world, you know, everything is symbolic, everything is political, every word is very carefully chosen, because if it's not, it tends to escalate out of control.
Right.
So I would pay very close attention to what the Pope says to the Israelis mm-hmm. about peace, what he says to the Palestinians about peace, and particularly, you know, does he have any harsh words for Prime Minister Netanyahu about the settlements expansion that have sort of mm-hmm. put a wrench in the peace process? Does he have anything to say to the Palestinians about the unity government that they're trying to form that has also thrown a wrench into the process? So watch his words very carefully, because they will be very carefully chosen.
I've been talking with Kevin Ekstrom, Editor-in-Chief of Religion News Service. You'll find ongoing coverage of the papal visit to the Holy Land, as well as the ways religion impacts our society and our world, at religionnews.com. Kevin, as always, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio and helping us out.
Happy to be with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to help us support this show today. We'll use your money wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners all across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that they simply can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you can find more about the show. You can hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. I hope you'll stay in touch with us throughout the week. You can do that via Facebook and Twitter. Our listener line, if you want to call, is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen. Join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.